Professor Quaylen, we're all grateful to you for a comprehensive and penetrating survey of the assumption by the courts of executive and legislative functions. Three distinguished legal scholars here on the panel will comment on and supplement Professor Quaylen's views. I find the degree to which the courts now touch the lives of all citizens alarming, not only in terms of the degree to which it infringes our freedoms, but perhaps rather than protects those freedoms, but perhaps even more for the way this trend further overloads, confuses, and bogs down the process of government and the functioning and the meshing of the public and private sectors of our society. The trend is all too clear, as Philip Quaylen has so powerfully developed. I hope that the panelists will touch on or tell us what the correctives may be. What shall we do? What can we do? We have seen, we know, that the process of constitutional amendment does not work very well. We do not have periodic constitutional conventions, as occur, for example, in my own state, New York, where every 25 years or so there's a convention which restates the Constitution. And the public either votes it up or votes it down. And on the whole, the public has been quite discriminating in ratifying the work of the effective conventions and defeating those produced by the inferior ones. What we have here is a runaway machinery for judicial intrusion, with the courts running the school system in Boston, and perhaps before long, the city of New York. We have the courts mandating an extension of executive authority, further involvement in directing executive action. Federal courts requiring expenditures, which the legislature has not sanctioned or provided for. Judges now determine with the aid of psychiatric experts what a proper system of psychiatric care in a mental hospital should be. And no desegregation decision that I know of has been stayed by the fact that there was not enough money, or that the other school and educational services will suffer, which are perfectly valid and necessary considerations for legislatures, executives, and administrators. But that kind of consideration, no judge deems worthy of notice. The courts are requiring due process in schools and in businesses, and we recently saw the Second Circuit Court of Appeals tell us that due process is required with respect to foundation action on grants, because after all, foundations are tax exempt and subject to regulation, so that now every disappointed grant seeker can take a foundation to court. When government expands, it can seem reasonable that the court must extend its reach also. It must consider issues of equity and due process and equal protection in all the varied areas of education, health, health care, housing, and access to governmental services of all type. It must consider the varied impact of new subsidies and controls and restrictions based on safety or environmental considerations. It is true that as government expands, it sets up quasi-judicial bodies to adjudicate difficult decisions. But there is only one route of appeal in our system for these multifarious quasi-judicial bodies, and that is to the federal courts, and only one final appeal to the Supreme Court. A responsible Congress would weigh the likelihood of all these forms of judicial extension and amplification before enacting legislation, but that doesn't happen. We see state courts intruding into local governments by directing for their states revolutions in school financing and zoning and in other areas which are traditionally the province of local governments. And I think the role of the private bar and the role of advocacy is worthy of note here. One of the major cogs in this machinery of judicial extension are the foundations and their activity, their growing activity, in supporting scores, probably hundreds, of public interest firms, public interest law firms, who always provide a lawyer to push the courts into exercising legislative and executive functions on every issue where that opportunity exists. And as these issues are joined in litigation, in cases that are argued, the side of the case which thrusts for further extension is likely to be well prepared, well argued, and to have the benefit of research, preparation, and experience which has been developed on a nationwide basis through the network of public interest law firms. And all too often, the side of the case that rests on judicial restraint is not that well argued, not that well prepared, or that well argued. And I think one of the things that can be hopefully looked to as a corrective here is an extension of the kind of work that the Pacific Legal Foundation does, and it has effectively and successfully participated in litigation and argument, which hopefully either have or hopefully will prevent the extension of court directives into welfare policy, into local zoning, and the efforts to have the courts mandate a zero growth policy in the state of California, efforts to intrude the courts into a vetoing of decisions by the military, which are necessary, in their view, for meet defense requirements. So there's a great range of practical considerations in how this trend is likely to develop, how it can be checked, how it can be molded, and I hope we'll hear some comment from our panelists on that aspect of this subject of this panel. I'm going to call